Was it your first introduction to the trail? Had you done any sections of it before, or you just decided to go for it?
I just wanted to go for it. I hadn't done any of it before.
What got you interested in doing such a long walk?
So there were a few things. My aunt and uncle biked across America. They did it in sections, but they did, I think, west to east. And my aunt got cancer before the last section in Maine, and she passed away. So the family got together when I was in middle school, and we all biked the last section ending, I think it's Arcadia Park, where it's the first place in America the sunrise touches, and then we scattered some of her ashes there. And, you know, you just camped along the way. And so I think that introduced the idea of such a vast distance as normal to me. My dad also backpacked and kayaked long distances. So I'd heard of long trails before. And
did you do much to prepare for it? Did you read? Did you train? Did you just get on the trail?
I came back from Peace Corps because I'd only been out of Peace Corps I'd only been in America for, I think, 6 months before doing it. So I was pretty out of shape after Peace Corps. It was like the longest period of time without physical exercise in my life. I hiked Petersburg Mountain and I hurt myself. So I tried to build up the stabilizing muscles in my knees and legs. I went to FlexFit with Alex. and
very good.
Yeah, tried to build that up. But I wasn't walking around town with, like, weights in my backpack or anything. I didn't have a car, so I was walking everywhere, but it's not the same as with, like, a 20 to 30-pound backpack.
Yeah, so what was your day like? So did you have an average you were shooting for every day for mileage, and were you carrying that kind of weight every day, or did you try to pare down what you were keeping in your pack?
It really depended on the section, because in the desert, there was a lot more access to towns, and it was warm weather, so my clothes were lighter. In the Sierras, I had to have a bear canister, and I also had to have an ice axe and warmer clothes and micro spikes. And it was a lot longer food carries, so I would carry up to 8 days of food at a time and had to eat really high-calorie food, and a lot of it, a lot of calories to keep going. So the food bag was, I'd say, over half of the weight in my backpack.
Okay, so you had, what, 30 or 40 pounds on your back? Or?
Thank goodness, no.
Okay.
I think at the heavy point, I tried to keep it low because my backpack wasn't made for, like, that much. It was made, like, for keeping an average around 25 pounds. And some people get really into that. They talk about even the weight of, like, their tent stakes. I didn't. Mm-hmm. I'm not much of a gearhead, so I almost never checked my backpack weight. I was just like, this doesn't feel good. And then I would try to get rid of some stuff. But I think maybe when it was at its heaviest, it was probably around 30 pounds, somewhere in there. And when it was at its lightest, it would be down to 20 or below 20 pounds.
There are people who try to go minimalist, not have a tent or a stove or anything. Did you bring all that stuff?
Oh, yeah. That's called ultralight.
Okay.
I called myself mediocre light. So, yeah, you can get these special backpacks, this special material. I think it used to be called Cuban fiber. It has a different name now. And they use only tarp tents, and they cold soak, where they just have a plastic container and put water and, say, like, oats in there, let it soak, and eat it hours later.
You weren't interested in that. You wanted a hot meal.
Yeah, I did, and I wanted a real tent that would keep the bugs out.
I wanted to ask about the trail conditions, because I know it changes pretty dramatically from year to year. Probably, like, the year before you did it, wildfires were the big story, but last year it was snowfall.
Yeah, so seeing pictures from the year before from NASA of the Sierra Nevada versus when I went through was crazy. So 2017 is really famous for having a really high snowpack, because I think it's April is usually when they do the annual measuring, and that's what they use to compare. But in 2017, the snowstorm stopped after that. This year was really unusual because they continued through May, full-on winter storms, crazy snow, winds. And at that point, there were some people from, like, Norway that were mountaineers going through, but it was pretty intense. But in June, I went through in late June, it was still 202% of the average snowpack. And 2017, which was the record holder for, like, highest snow since, like, I don't know, the 50s or something, was at 190%. So because they don't usually average then, don't really know where it is in the records. But I know that 2017 was a record-breaking year. And when I went through, it was higher than it was that year by 12%.
So what does that mean for challenges in hiking for the for person who's never thought about doing this? I mean, the streams are swollen with snowmelt.
Yeah, yeah.
What else?
Yeah, river crossings are pretty dangerous. Places were labeled as streams and creeks were lakes and white water that you just like could not walk through. I went through 2 weeks after peak melt, so stuff was still pretty swollen. And you, it's nice, there's an application that you can read where logs are. People can comment and they say, if you go up this way, there's three logs and you can jump from this log to this log and find your way across without having to wade through. So I mostly did that. I almost never just went straight for it. I always took the safer ways to go around.
You didn't have any dangerous near swims or?
No, I managed to avoid that. People who went through at the same time as me, I would talk to them. And they did, but I was super cautious. So I talked to people that, like, maybe I went across a log, and I have no shame. So I sat down, and I butt-scooted across it. And there were some people that would try to just walk across it, and I heard stories about people falling off and almost being swept away, people having to grab them, people walking across streams, rivers, when I didn't, and almost being knocked over, losing shoes, being grabbed by a friend. But I didn't want to chance that. So
that was down low, up high on the mountaintops mm-hmm. with that level of snowfall. What were you dealing with?
It was pretty crazy. Most switchbacks were covered. And so switchbacks are where it's really vertical. And when there's no switchbacks, then it's just snow, almost vertical snow. And so often it was actually safer to not take the trail. And you had to... We would ask people that were coming southbound sometimes, or maybe you could find comments about the safest route that people have found to avoid avalanches. I would start very early in the morning. Usually we tried to start between 4 and 6 in the morning. It would take us over an hour to do a mile a lot of the time.
Because snow is frozen then at that point, so you can...
Yes.
A lot safer.
Yes, a lot safer. You can kick in solid footholds. And we would go straight up. There's one pass called Mather's Pass, and it's not the highest, which earlier I had it in my mind that it was the highest pass that's going to be the scariest. But actually, it was this one because it has a big cornice hanging over at the top, and they were still having avalanches at the point I was going through if you waited too late in the day. And so you could go up the left-hand side of it and do this boulder scrambling, and there would still be snow in between. And then you were above the trail and you had to go horizontal, and it was basically a cliff face. And if you fell, I forget what they called it, a no-slip zone, you would die if mm-hmm. you fell there. So you had to be very careful sliding from boulder to boulder, not to kick rocks out from underneath of you. It's slippery snow and ice.
You weren't roped.
Not roped, no. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I think it was a mile, and it took us over 2 hours to do it. And then... yeah, and I have a horrible, horrible fear of heights. It's like total phobia. and so I had friends holding my hands and helping me across, telling me where to place my feet. Also, I was happy I went through with a very large group through the Sierras. And one of the people in my group was a man in his 50s who was a mountaineer that had done lots of stuff. So I felt much safer trusting his advice. And then going down the backside of that, the trail was completely covered in snow, and you're trying to go down this ravine. So if you went too far to one side, there was a giant drop down into, like, waterfalls, basically going down for miles. And then the other side was cliffs. So you had to try to stay in between them and not lose the trail. But the application on the phone that most people use for navigation wasn't able to connect there because the mountains, and so there was a lot of trail finding in that space trying to get... So the challenge did not end once you got up the first side.
Was that cliffside your scariest moment on the trail?
I think that, yeah, Mather's was the scariest.
Yeah, no bear encounters or weird people encounters or...
There was a bear encounter. It was at night, me and two other young women, and they were both already in their tents, and there were some eyes circling our camp. And when it was just me yelling, it wouldn't go away until I got the other people to yell. But maybe growing up here, that didn't scare me as much. There was one time when I was in Northern California and I was walking alone down a road because I'd had to return a key. I was the only one that went back. It was nighttime. So I didn't have on all my gear, which made me look bigger. And this time it was just me looking all small and human. And there was a cougar on top of a hill to my right yowling. Like, I think it was a territory call. So that was kind of scary because they don't usually mess with hikers because we look really big with our backpacks on. But when you take off all your gear, you look a lot more vulnerable.
Wow. So you got most of the way, but not all the way.
Yes, I got. So out of 2,653 miles, I have 295 and a half miles left. So
that means you were stopped somewhere in Washington State.
I did every single mile. So there's something, it's called being a purist, is when you don't miss a step. Some people take side trails in early, maybe come out a different trail, or there is an old Forest Service road that'll cut off a mile or two, and it's just easier. Maybe you don't have to walk a scary ledge if you do that. But I walked every single step of the mile until I got to Washington, and it was like the earliest snowfall in 100 years this year, and I got stopped by that. I hiked through the snow for a little bit, but then it was starting to build up to the point the avalanches were happening and landslides.
Was that a difficult decision to have to end?
It was extremely difficult. There was one time when I missed 66 miles. It was the first time missing a single mile, and I had to skip 66, where if we'd gotten a hitch up north, we could have hiked south and maybe beat the snowstorm, but my friends didn't want to do it, and I had to make the choice of having a friend go with me who didn't really want to be there and putting him in a potentially dangerous situation for my own ego, and I decided that that wasn't worth it. And then also deciding to get off trail was partially because the people that continued had to buy all new winter gear. My stuff wasn't winter gear, so it was finances, and also, once again, a bit of ego and entitlement and assuming that search and rescue would come out in a snowstorm to find you, because storms were rolling through those mountain passes already and potentially putting other people in danger because you wanted to keep going.
You have the days written down of how many days total you are out there. So what's that give you for an average and all?
So days that you don't hike any trail miles are called 0 days. And I took a lot of them in the desert because I was letting the snow in the Sierras melt. And then I took a lot in the Sierras because I was exhausted. So in total, I took, I think it was 41 or 42 zeros. And I was on the trail for about 5.5 months. So I took over a month of those days I wasn't hiking.
Okay, all right. And then, so average walk when you were walking?
My average walk when I was walking was a little over 19 miles per day.
Well, pretty good. Mm. And especially over that terrain from what I've read about it. Challenging.
Yeah. Challenging and beautiful.
So you had probably had some 30 days and some 10 days.
Yeah. Yeah. So included in that average is some days where I literally hiked like 1 mile, and then my longest day was 41 miles. Oh, wow.
Did you have a favorite part of the trail? I know it varies pretty considerably from the desert to the mountains to the flats of Oregon.
Yeah. I had a really hard time choosing. And the thing with doing a through hike instead of a section hike is that you don't necessarily get to go through somewhere when it is at its best. There were a few places that we went through where the locals were like, why are you guys always here at this time of year? But it's just because when you're going through, that's when you hit that point. But we were pretty lucky this year because another effect of the high precipitation was that it was a super bloom in the desert. So instead of the usual brown scenery, we had green and all the cacti were flowering, and there were just, you'd be on top of a mountain, you look down and the ground would look yellow, but it was actually a giant field of yellow flowers. It was really gorgeous.
Wow, you got some good photos, I imagine.
Yeah, I hope so. I tried.
I imagine getting water was probably not much of a challenge because of all that snowpack.
Yeah. So the desert, the longest carry there. So there's in the desert, there's a lot of, it's called trail angels. It's people that just help out of the good of their heart. And so there were water caches along the way that, say, cut down a 40-mile water carry to only 20 miles. So then you'd be carrying, like, 5 liters of water for 20 miles, and that's, like, over 12 pounds, about 13 pounds of water. Whereas in the Sierras, we could just have a single bottle of water and just refill it at all the streams because the water was just constant there.
You mentioned some other people. Did you hike the whole way with others? What was your take on the people that you met along the way? Did you like having other people on the trail? Was it too crowded? What was your whole take on that?
Yeah, I had this really like idealistic idea of just being so quiet out there and all this time alone. And in the desert, it was crazy. If I sat down for 10 minutes, multiple people would pass me. It was really packed. It's called the bubble, the group of people, because there's permits. There's a prime time to start. 50 people can start per day from the southern terminus. And I was in the middle of the bubble. And there'd be waves where you wouldn't even know it, but you were somewhere, and maybe there were 30 of you there in a town, and the night before there was 70. But you'd have no clue unless somebody told you that all those people had just been there. And then a lot of people flipped, which means that they switched their directions because of the snowpack in the Sierras. I heard that, I don't know if it's true, there's lots of rumors on the trail, but I heard like 10% of people went straight through the Sierras this year because of the snowpack. So a lot of the bubble got broken up then because they went north to Washington and started hiking south. And then it got a lot more quiet. So I was with people pretty constantly in the desert. I hiked with a few different groups. Then I found a big group that I went through the Sierras with. And then I was like, I need to make up time. So I hiked the 600 miles in Northern California more alone, kind of sometimes hiking with people, camping the same spot, but mostly alone. And it was interesting to compare the challenges of hiking with, say, 10 people, which slows you down a bit, all finding places where you all fit, but also you have all this emotional support. If you're having a bad day, there's probably someone else by you who's also having one and you can talk about it. They make you laugh. If you fall off a mountain, someone's going to notice. And then, yeah, it was an interesting comparison to Northern California, where honestly, it was probably my least favorite section. So I just was trying to burn through it and get out of there. And so I went faster, but I was maybe less happy.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you just came out of the Peace Corps, jumped into doing this. Those are two pretty dramatically different experiences, right?
Yeah.
I mean, to think about. What do you take out of this experience?
Some things about the experiences were really similar in that they were very individual-based mental challenges. Also, lots of physical challenges, like not a comfortable place to go to the bathroom and dangers of not clean water. But on the trail, I think something that was very obvious and an obvious takeaway was that the surest way to not change something is to sit down and stay where you are. Like, I was not having a good time in Northern California. I didn't like the scenery. I didn't like where the trail was. But by sitting down and just taking a break and feeling bad for myself, it was the surest way that I was going to spend more time there. And also having that horrible fear of heights and still going through the Sierras, especially this year, was first off really great to see what good support can do. Having good friends to help me was really important. But also, I got a lot more confidence in myself and what I can overcome and in believing in myself. That day that I went over Mathers, I don't know if it was probably both altitude sickness and stress, but I was throwing up and I was super weak. And I still like rock climbed over this pass. And when you do that at the end, you feel like really invincible. And really just this internal strength. So I guess believing in yourself in order to overcome things and not giving up.
I've read that it's hard to adjust to your new life after being on the trail. Is that what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I experienced that after Peace Corps and after the trail both times. I think that both of those communities, you're in groups of people that are excited to connect. You're in these groups of people that you automatically have something in common. And then you step back outside and you forget how to socialize with people outside of those environments. It's also, I was really happy to come back to Petersburg because when I was in Oregon, the constant sound of traffic and just the constant proximity to people was really jarring. How hard it was to get outdoors, like that the outdoors are inaccessible. And then for both of those, it was really hard to come back, and it's so regulated, especially here in more developed countries. All the rules, all the things you have to do, a lot more expectations from outside are put in on you instead of kind of more free-form dependence on yourself. So there's benefits, like all these things are available, and it's amazing. It's right there, and you appreciate all these little things, like I have a drawer full of socks instead of just two pairs. If I lose one sock, it's like not the end of the world. But on the other hand, seeing the difficulties, say, of what it takes to move somewhere, to get a job, you have to have a house, but to have a house, you have to have a job. And all of those complexities can be really overwhelming after how simple it is out there, where everything you own and need to literally survive is on your back.
So there are more long trails out there. Do you have interest in doing more of that?
Well, I want to go back and finish what I missed on the trail for sure, preferably at a time when there's wildflowers and it's sunny and I can go swimming in all the lakes. And I don't know if I want to do another full through hike. I've gone back and forth on that. But there is a few trails that are like 500 to 1,000 miles. And I think that would be really nice because it'd be easier to choose to do those right when the time is right, right when it's really beautiful, and to be able to pause and swim in those lakes and appreciate those fields of wildflowers instead of thinking about, oh my gosh, if I take this break, I'm not going to finish this goal that I have for myself. Maybe have it be more about appreciating nature than overcoming nature.
You felt like you were on a pretty tight schedule with...
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, there you'd be hiking and there'd be like an unforgettable camp spot or an amazing lake that most people never get to see because you had to walk tens of miles to get here. But you can't stop because you have a schedule. You have to get somewhere.
Well, multiple reasons. You're getting to your next food supply, I imagine.
Yeah.
Or...
yeah, you next food supply. If you're hiking with people, you don't want to lose them because just a day behind someone is almost impossible to catch them again. 20 miles, 10 miles, 3 miles is a lot when you have to walk up to that person and they're also walking at the exact same pace as you. And then... yeah, maybe weather is coming in, seasons are changing, you're worried about the water sources drying up, you got to get out of there before that happens. A lot of factors pushing you along.